Today's episode is brought to you by Freetrade, the commission-free investment platform. Welcome to Many Happy Returns, where we aim to make you a better investor. I'm Roman.
And I'm Michael.
A stock market crash early in retirement can leave you struggling to live off your investments. Today, I look at my plan to de-risk my portfolio as I get close to hanging up my microphone.
I want to know how to manage sequence of returns risk and whether bonds are really going to save us. And in today's dumb question of the week, is a stock market crash good for long-term returns? Okay, let's get into it. So when you're approaching retirement, there's traditionally been this view that there's a danger zone, maybe the few years before and the few years after you retire, where a stock market crash and a fall in the value of your portfolio can be really dangerous for the rest of your retirement, as in you might run out of money should that happen.
Yeah, because once you retire, if you have a drawdown early on, then there's a lot of compounding you're going to miss out on if you're crystallizing some loss early on. So if you sell some stock fund, for example, after it's fallen 30%, 40%, then you've destroyed some capital that won't be compounding for a long period of time. So that is a problem. And that's why some people de-risk just before they retire and just after they retire. That's to avoid these drawdowns early on.
Because we always talk about selling in a crash as like the worst thing you can do. And typically that comes about because of bad behavior. People get scared and they sell. But what we're talking about here on retirement is you're forced to sell because you need the money to live.
You don't have a choice about selling something. The thing is to sell something which hasn't crashed. And so you've just got to make sure there will be something in your portfolio which won't have crashed when you need the money.
So the classic approach is to de-risk your portfolio a little bit before you reach that point of maximum danger before retirement, isn't it?
Yeah, before it crashes, that's the goal. Yeah. Because what you don't want to do is, like, even 10 years before you retire, if there's a stock market crash, at that point, you're not going to sell some of your stock, which has fallen. You'd wait for it to recover. So it's not that easy to plan it if there is a little bit of volatility just before you retire.
I guess it raises the immediate question of, well, how soon is too soon to de-risk? Because there's obviously a downside to de-risking is that your expected returns in future will be lower.
That's right. So if you're going to have money in safe stuff, then that's going to be a drag on return. For bonds, it's usually about 4% less per year relative to stocks. And for money market funds, probably a couple more percent lower. So that's the trade-off. How much do you put into safe stuff and reduce your returns usually by doing that? And how much are you going to have in this safe bucket in order to avoid drawdown in case something bad does happen?
And when are you going to do it? How soon is too soon?
Yeah, and all of this stuff, you can do back tests to work out what would have worked pretty well.
So how are you thinking about these things then? So I don't want to be rude, but you presumably are starting to think about what you're going to do when you're no longer running PensionCraft every day.
Yeah, I mean, I do think about it and I have planned it. And I did make a video for members talking about what I was planning to do with my portfolio because people ask, they're intrigued about how I manage my own money. So I thought, well, I'll come up with a plan and I'll share it with the members. And I think they were a bit surprised because I've got so much equity in my portfolio and I'm going to keep it until I die at almost 100% equity. There will be a period just before I retire. I said about 5 years before I retire, but it depends on those factors we discussed, whether there's a drawdown beforehand, but also 5 years into retirement. So I will have that kind of 10-year span where I de-risk, but I'll de-risk as little as possible to keep the returns as high as possible. And several members, usually the ones which lived through the financial crisis, are the ones who said, I don't think that's enough of a buffer. I lived through these crises and, you know, I saw huge drawdowns and I wouldn't think that would be safe enough.
Well, you can have a period of 10 or maybe even 20 years in extremis where your portfolio doesn't recover.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on where you live and which market you've invested in. If it's global, I think it's less likely that you're going to have those very, very long drawdowns. But if you do have local exposure to your local stock market, then yeah, sure, there have been long periods when markets didn't return. Japan's just recovered, for example, from its drawdown in the 80s. So it really depends where you live. And Italy hasn't recovered at all. So I think as long as you have that global exposure, I think the long drawdowns are less likely.
And the other point is that you just can't completely de-risk it. There's a genuine trade-off to be made from covering those few scenarios when you model it that everything's going to go wrong versus the vast majority of cases where you'll just be hurting your standard of living for the long term by being too cautious for too long.
And again, if there's anything I've learned from working in PensionCraft and making the videos I've made, it's that it's usually better to have more risk in your portfolio than I would have planned to do if I hadn't done the research, because that usually tends to do pretty well. And you always have to couch it in these weird probabilistic words like tends to, is likely to, because you don't know what's going to happen. You can just look back in time and calibrate your expectations based on probability. But given what I know, I think I'd now be in the right mindset to have more risk in future. And some of the members were a bit surprised by that.
So you said you think maybe 5 years before your expected retirement. And I say expected because who knows, right? This is one of the unknowns. You might have to retire sooner through ill health, or you might choose to work longer if you're still enjoying it, right? But 5 years before your expected retirement, you expect to, what, put some money aside into safer assets? Which assets are you looking at?
So for me, it would depend on yields at the time that I retire. So for example, if we've got a very steep yield curve, then you're getting compensated for taking more duration risk, and I'd be willing to do that. If the curve's kind of flat or inverted, then money market funds would probably make more sense. So it really depends on the state of the fixed income market when I retire. But those are just the whistles and bells, really. My way of planning for this is to say, if I'm going to be crystallizing a loss, then what I want to do is to put something into my safe bucket, whatever that bucket is, cash, money markets, single government bonds. And the amount I put into it would depend on how long I think the drawdown will last in stocks. So let's say that I think that stocks usually recover in about 3 years. Then I'll put about 3 years of spending money into my safe pot. And I'll do that about 5 years before I retire.
And presumably you won't start eating into that safe bucket unless there is a market crash. So you'll keep it for this period where you want extra safety.
Exactly. And so that dry powder would be there just in case there is a crash. And if there isn't a crash, I don't use it. I just draw down on the equity.
I guess it's dry powder in a sense, but it's not dry powder you plan to pile into the market if there's a market crash. It's dry powder in the sense that it's powdered food like an astronaut would take. It's there to eat off if you need it.
That's right. It's not voluntary. It's more kind of emergency rations.
And is it any drawdown in stocks which would see you tap into your money market funds and your gilts, or would it need to be a severe drawdown?
This was the other question. And I think, again, the statistics help you here. If it's going to be a 10% drawdown, they happen quite frequently. So I don't think that would be enough to make me draw on the reserves.
Not breaking the glass for 10%.
No, that's right. I think 20% would definitely have me looking at it. 30% would be a defo.
And if you retire into that really unfortunate scenario of a pronounced long market drawdown, in the worst case, I guess, the 3 years of spending money you've got set aside might not be enough. And then you just do have to sort of bite the bullet and start selling some stocks to live off, even though you're crystallizing it at depressed valuations.
Yeah, you don't have any choice. I wouldn't like it. It wouldn't be a pleasant experience, but I'd have to do it. And, you know, it's not catastrophic. It's recoverable. It really depends on how big your pot is relative to your cash requirements in future. If it's a little bit touch and go, whether your pot's going to last for your lifetime, then you'd be much more careful. And this is another point I made when I was talking to the members about this, which is if you've got vast excess savings, or another source of income like a big buy-to-let property portfolio or a defined benefit pension, which you've maxed out, then, you know, this isn't such a big issue because you can just live off the other stuff, the other income.
And if you're retiring at a traditional retirement age where the state pension is coming in for you, then that's going to provide some cash, which is inflation-linked and can at least provide some of your living expenses.
Yeah, this is it. I think people forget the size of the state pension. It covers not a huge amount, but certainly some of your expenses. So whatever you're building up in your pension pot is just on top of that. So I think overall, you've got to take a view in the round as to what your income is and what your savings are when you're thinking about how cautious you're going to be in that drawdown period.
And I suppose if everything goes well here and you've set aside your safe money, you've gone through that dangerous period around retirement and there's not been a significant market crash, you've not even touched your safe money, at some point you want to get that back to work in the stock market, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, people talk about de-risking. They don't talk about re-risking. And this is the surprising thing. Whenever you go back and do back tests on which strategy is best for retirees, having a very large equity allocation usually produces the best outcomes because stocks return more. That very simple fact has so many consequences. And that's the one I've really learnt since I've been working in PensionCraft. And it's contrary to my opinion before I retired. I just assumed the glide path from Vanguard. Let's just explain what that means. If you buy one of these Vanguard target retirement funds, you can see that they've got this traditional approach, which is you start off with lots of equity when you're young, not many bonds, and then gradually as you enter retirement, you dial down the amount of equity and dial up the bonds with the belief that you don't want to take much risk at that point, with inflation linkers coming in at the end as well, just to give you that inflation-linked income. But this is completely contrary to that you keep equity in your portfolio until the day you die. And if anything, you increase the risk as you get past that critical period, just around retirement.
It is counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you think, well, I'm going to be old. I'm not a risk taker anymore.
This is it. You know, as I munch my digestive biscuits on the beach or whatever it is I do at that point, then, you know, who knows whether I'd want to have that huge equity exposure. But certainly the back test suggests that I should. If I was thinking about terminal wealth, if I was thinking about leaving money to my kids or to a donkey sanctuary or whatever I choose to leave it to, cockapoo sanctuary probably.
I guess the goal in terms of optimization is a few things, isn't it? It's trying to retire with as big a pot as possible because that will allow you to spend more in retirement. It's maximizing your money available for consumption throughout the whole of your life. And it's potentially dying with as big a pot as possible to leave onto your heirs. It's those three things. And there's somewhat in conflict, right? The more you spend in retirement, there's going to be less of a pot to pass on.
But those are the criteria you look at. That's exactly right. It's wealth at retirement, it's quality of life during retirement, and it's terminal wealth, how much you've got in the pot when you die, which you leave to your beneficiaries.
Yeah, and the approach we've discussed, this glide path where, like Vanguard has in their target retirement date funds, you start risky with lots of stocks and you end up safe with lots of bonds. That's been uncontroversial, I guess, until quite recently. There was a paper, I believe last year, that challenged that assumption.
Yeah, that's right. There was a great paper called Beyond the Status Quo. Good start. A critical assessment of life cycle investment advice.
Would it be too strong to describe this as a bombshell paper in the world of retirement planning?
No, I don't think so. Certainly for me, it was a bombshell. I'd kind of seen things along these lines before. I'd read Abraham Okasunya's book, which is Beyond the 4% Rule, which kind of hints at this as well. It talks about very high equity allocations and how that's usually best, even in retirement, deep into retirement. So I was kind of clued up to it already. Plus, there was a great paper I read, which doesn't sound like it's to do with this, but it is. It's called Is Rebalancing a Portfolio During Retirement Necessary? And this is by John Spitzer and Sandeep Singh, which comes up with a similar result, which is that usually it's best to sell your safe stuff first and end up with more equity towards the end of your retirement. So there are a lot of things that were pointing in this direction, but this paper was the one that really lifted the veil for my eyes, as it were.
So this new one, which is Beyond the Status Quo, what is their challenge to the status quo? What are they saying is more optimal than a glide path?
Well, if I just look at the abstract, it comes up with these incredible statements. It says, we challenge two central tenets of life cycle investing. Number one, investors should diversify across stocks and bonds. So what's he saying? That we shouldn't diversify? And that really got my goat. And then the second one is the young should hold more stocks than the old. Well, yeah, surely that's true.
They sound like kind of truisms in the world of investing. You should diversify and take more risk when you're young. But I like that they're being challenged.
Yeah. And I love these things. I love these things where you read a paper and it completely flies in the face of what you believe. And this one certainly did. And what they're suggesting is that an even mix of domestic stocks, that's for US investors, it's very US-based, the paper, and 50% international stocks, which is what US people called non US stocks. Held throughout one's lifetime, vastly outperforms age-based stock bond strategies in building wealth, supporting retirement consumption, preserving capital, and generating bequests. So those are the three criteria we were talking about.
It's basically saying that throughout your whole life, you should just hold 100% stocks, albeit with this 50-50 split between domestic and international. And that will give you better outcomes on average and with fewer really bad outcomes than like a 60-40 portfolio or a glide path-based portfolio.
Exactly. And that was really surprising to me. So I really dug into the paper to see what they were saying and whether it was true and how they approached it. And the empirical stuff looks pretty sound. There was one thing which they did, which was a little bit unusual, which surprised me. But apart from that, it's all fairly standard backtesting analysis.
So before we get onto any potential limitations in the study, like what have they actually done? What have they been modelling to determine the best investment strategy?
So firstly, this is a simulation approach where they simulate couples based on empirical data, and they simulate everything about their life. So firstly, how long they live. They use actuarial tables for that. They assume it's a heterosexual couple living together. So the salaries reflect that based on US income data.
And they also assume periods out of the workforce where you might have been laid off for a while.
Again, which is empirically based on real data on employment in the United States. They also use the US benefit system. So they work out what the typical retirement income would be for an American retiree.
And I think they assume that people start saving at age 25 and they save 10% of their gross income throughout their working lives.
And they retire at 65. So that's the way they approached it. So the Social Security calculations were based on a US investor. The returns were based on a US investor. So very much a US-based thing. Another assumption which they made was that there's a constant real withdrawal rate of 4% of the household's investment account value at retirement.
That's a standard rule. I mean, it's not the optimal withdrawal strategy, but it's a simple one which a lot of people follow.
They also had an interesting data set which included 38 countries and cumulative historical data set of 2,500 years. But also it includes 10-year government bond returns. So it is a very comprehensive database of historical returns that they used.
When you say 2,500 years of returns, I think that's if you add up all the different countries.
That's all of the series. Yeah, it didn't go back to before Christ. No. Yeah.
It's not Moses' investment portfolio, no.
No, it wasn't the S&P in 500 BC, no.
But it is pretty comprehensive what they've done. And then they've looked at these assumed lives for, I think, 1 million different couples and weighed up how various different portfolios perform.
And they classified their strategies into three groups. The first one was safe harbor strategies, one of which was the target date fund approach, like Vanguard, or maybe 60-40 or age-based, 100 minus your age, that kind of thing.
So basically where you're balancing stocks and bonds in a nice mix, which should hopefully make your drawdowns less painful, but without compromising too much return.
Yeah, so you're dialing down the risk over time. Then they've got the capital preservation strategy, which is stick it all into T-bills, in other words, money market funds forever.
That's not going to go well.
No, it certainly didn't. And then finally, we've got equity strategies, which is 100% stocks, i.e. domestic, or 50-50 US and non-US. So a globally diversified portfolio.
And 50-50 US and non-US is not that far off where a market cap weighted global fund would be right now.
Yeah.
A little underweight US, but not much.
And where it has been since 1950, roughly. So, you know, that is the typical shape of markets for the last 70 years.
And what do they find?
Well, the shocking thing is if you look at the 50th percentile, this is the typical case. The one which really stands out, and not just by a little bit, but by a lot, is the international stock portfolio. So 50% US, 50% non-US, where the real wealth at retirement were just much better for that global equity portfolio than any of the other strategies, including the ones which were the target date fund approach.
See, for me, that's not the surprising thing. Like, I would expect stocks to outperform a 60-40 or whatever in terms of accumulating wealth at the date of retirement. The shocking thing to me was that the 100% stocks diversified globally allows much greater consumption throughout retirement on average than the diversified stock bond portfolios.
For me, the surprise was actually that the 10th percentile, you know, these are the really bad outcomes, was actually better in the international stock case.
Which would imply that bonds don't save you.
I think the problem with bonds is that they don't recover much after a crash, whereas stocks usually do. And that produces a real drag on returns coming out of one of these crises, when stocks usually bounce back pretty well. Historically, they have done. Today's podcast is sponsored by Freetrade, the UK commission-free investing platform. Freetrade are offering our podcast listeners a free bonus share worth between £10 and £100. All you need to do is join the platform and fund your account with at least £50. The free share will be added to your account within 7 to 10 days of funding. Here's what the Freetrade platform offers you. Over 6,100 UK, US and European stocks, ETFs and trusts at your fingertips. Commission-free trades to keep your profits, interest on uninvested cash, recurring orders, and an easy-to-use app. Ready to claim your free share? Head over to freetrade.io/pensioncraft to benefit from this offer. When you invest, your capital is at risk, the probability is weighted, so more expensive shares will be rarer, terms and conditions and other charges may apply.
I saw an interview with the author of this paper, and he speculated that the reason why bonds don't protect you in the long term as much as you might think in the truly bad cases where there's a market crash at retirement is that, yes, bonds do often diversify stocks in the short term. So you've got a stock market crash and bonds rally, like happened in the financial crisis. But that over the decades, stocks and bonds do tend to move together. It's just a short-term hedge, not a long-term hedge.
Yeah, that's usually a good way to think about bonds. You don't want to allocate money there for a long period of time. So if you're early on in your investment career, you probably don't want lots of bonds. But at any point, you don't want bonds for a long period of time because they underperform. I mean, there were other statistics where the very safe strategy did better. For example, crash size. So there, obviously, the bills strategy, where you just put it into money market funds, which are ultra safe, that drew down least. No surprises there. And the stock portfolio drew down more. But the international stocks, interestingly, drew down a lot less than just domestic stocks. So if you invest in the S&P 500, it's more crashy. Those crashes tend to be deeper and longer than if you invest in a globally diversified portfolio. And that's a very important lesson at the moment, because many people I speak to say, you know, I'm just going to put it into US stocks because they perform best. Well, actually, no, they don't. And they crash more, and you'd be better off spreading your money across more markets if you can. The other point that they made in the paper, which is an interesting one, is that if you look at 30-year returns, rather than taking, say, one-month returns and adding them all up, is that the diversification you get for equity risk from bonds is less than you might think. During periods when equity fell long-term, usually bonds fell as well. And because they recover less quickly, they didn't really offer the hedge that people expect. So that was interesting. They approached this simulation in long blocks of time, 30 years rather than little one-month periods. And that made a huge difference to the analysis.
I think that's the right way to go. Like, I have this feeling that everyone underestimates their time horizon. People think, I'm going to get to retirement. Like, that's my time horizon. I retire.
Yeah.
And that's what my pot needs to be at retirement. And which is true if you're buying an annuity, right? And you just want as big a pot as possible to buy an annuity. But you could easily live for 30, 40 years plus past your date of retirement. And if you look at it on a couple basis, as we've said before, the odds that one of you makes it to 100 is surprisingly high. The conclusion that I take from this paper, if we buy into their methodology, is that 100% stocks is going to perform better on, well, every metric as far as this paper is concerned, so long as behaviorally you don't get scared and sell in a crash, because the crashes will be big in stocks.
And that's the other assumption, which is that you're okay with this, that you can live with it. And really, for me, that's been what I've been programming myself to do over the last 5 or 6 years, is just get used to the fact that stocks will crash and arrange my behavior, but also my investment strategy around that assumption, because it's going to happen, like you say. So you better learn to love it. But if you embrace that volatility, I think you'll probably end up with better outcomes if you believe the results of this paper.
Yeah, they have a stat which they call risk of ruin, which is basically the idea that will you run out of money? What's the probability you're going to run out of money in retirement? And the interesting thing was that, you know, going all stocks lowers your probability of ruin than glide path based approaches or a diversified stock bond portfolio, so long as you don't do the bad behavior. And that's a big assumption for a lot of people.
And the ruin probabilities are shocking. So this is the chance that you run out of money across a million different bootstrap simulations, they call it. For the international stock portfolio, the one which did best on all the other metrics, on almost all of them, the ruin probability is 8.2%. For the target date fund approach, it's 17%. So over twice as much ruin probability.
To me, that's the shocking thing from this paper, because I'd always thought that, yes, on average, stocks are going to return more, and therefore, at my date of death, I'm much more likely to have a big pot if I go all in stocks. However, there's probably more chance I'll run out of money because they're volatile. This says the opposite of that, that there's less chance you'll run out of money with stocks than with a diversified stock bond portfolio. And the even more shocking thing is that that holds true even in the far left tail. Even in the worst case scenarios where there's a crash in the stock market at retirement, the 100% stock portfolios have less risk of ruin than the stock bond portfolios.
What they don't show you in this is maybe a fear index throughout your life. Because I think, imagine that you're going through retirement and stocks crash 40, 50%, which does happen. And you see what was, I don't know, £1 million become 500,000. Who wouldn't, in their right mind, be terrified at that point? What the hell have we done? We've put everything into stocks. They've halved in value. We're stuffed. I mean, that,
yeah.
Who wouldn't think that?
This is the risk if you retire in the year 2000, right? You retire, you think, wow, look at all this money I've built up. Wow, Cisco's doing so well. And then boom, dot-com bubble burst, you're 50% down. And you actually won't recover in real terms for, I think, 13 years, because you've got the financial crisis coming straight after this.
Yeah, that was a very, very extreme case. But even then, you know, you did recover, but it wouldn't have been a comfortable ride.
You just have to hang on for dear life and trust those back tests, I guess. But like you say, a lot of people, maybe even most people, would probably get scared and do the wrong thing in that scenario. And if you look at stats about how people perform versus how the optimal investor performs, people underperform their funds that they hold by around 2% on an annual basis, which is a huge underperformance because they do the wrong thing at the wrong time. They try to time the market and therefore hurt their returns.
So all of the stuff I do is building a portfolio where I can't do that and trying to control my behavior. So I spend so much time designing a portfolio so that I wouldn't do that. And my solution was to come up with just a single fund. That was my solution to stop me behaving badly, because I can't. I'm not going to be able to sell it if there's a crash, because I won't allow myself to. All I can do is add more to it. And as soon as I get money, I put it in. So I think that's the real problem with this approach, which is not everyone's going to be comfortable with 100% equities and the psychological trauma that comes with it. Unless you're someone who can program yourself to not care, to be indifferent to the drawdowns and to know what's best in the long run. You've got to have some kind of Vulcan mentality in order to be able to do that, and a logic-based approach, or at least an empirical approach.
Yeah, those million simulations they did, they behaved perfectly. That's not the real world, is it?
No. I think what they should have done is actually build that in, or at least come up with an ulcer index for each of the strategies, which shows you how long and how deep the drawdowns were, because those are the really worrying things. Because we always anchor based on the latest peak of our wealth. And we always compare our wealth with that peak rather than where we started, which probably would make more sense.
Yeah, you could build in, I guess, that kind of investor psychological bias and change the real returns in the model so they're 2% lower for stocks than they should be, for example.
Yeah, some kind of return penalty.
It'd be interesting to see if bonds actually made it in that scenario. But then people probably underperform bond funds as well. But as we said when you first introduced this paper, a lot of their findings are quite counterintuitive and fly in the face of everything we've heard about how to invest for retirement. Has it changed any of your thinking around what you might do with your money?
I think it has. I'd already had a clue that this was the right way to do it when I was reading that Is Rebalancing a Portfolio During Retirement Necessary paper, that this was the best approach. You start off with some safe stuff and you sell that first. And that was my first shock. But what this has done is really make me see the benefit of not having any bonds at all. Now, as you know, Michael, I'm a big fan of bonds. I love them.
It's true. I imagine you were crying when you were reading this paper. My baby, what have they done to my beautiful boy?
But overall, I think, you know, there's still scope for bonds. You can still, you know, have a little bond flutter now and then. If you've got a big expenditure coming around the corner, you don't want to have a risky pot for that expenditure, then you could squirrel away the cost of a holiday, the cost of a car into one of these government bonds. And when it matures, it's payday and woohoo, you can spend it.
That's the weakest defense of bonds I've ever heard you give, I have to say.
But overall, what it shows is that bonds are toxic. And if you've got a long-term portfolio, which most of us have when it comes to pensions, then having no bonds at all for a long period of time is usually the best thing. So I think it reframes risk in terms of long-term returns when bonds are actually more risky than stocks, which is non-intuitive. And it's something I've been saying for a while now, which is that, you know, for a long period of time, bonds are riskier because of their low return. So really all this did was to cross the T's and dot the I's on the actual ruin probabilities, terminal wealth, consumption and retirement, all of that. Now, I'm not saying it's a perfect analysis, and I'd never go completely down one rabbit hole based on one paper. There's going to be refutations of this. Maybe they got something wrong. Maybe they got one of the spreadsheet columns signs wrong. You never know. But because there have been other papers which suggest this is the way to go, I'm actually very much going toward this way of allocating. And this is why I'm planning to do that for my retirement right now. I might change it between now and the time I retire, but it certainly changed my thinking to some degree, yeah.
As I said, I watched an interesting interview with the author of the paper. And he said, we've been a little bit misinterpreted here because it's been reported a lot that, wow, stocks is risk-free. Just go all into stocks for retirement. And he says, well, yes, that is like the best approach based on the numbers, but it's not risk-free. Our data shows that you'll still fail and run out of money in 8% of cases. It's just that you've got to allocate to something. This looks like a better approach than the traditional approaches.
And that's a difficulty which we have. We have to reason under uncertainty, and people aren't comfortable doing that. You don't want maybes, you want certainties in retirement. But the cost of certainty will be underperformance because you'll probably go for something which has too little risk in it. Now, there was a lot of discussion of this paper within our PensionCraft community, and I've talked about some of the responses that we got. That's great because you could join the conversation too. If you want to do that and learn more, just go to our website, pensioncraft.com.
Okay, today's dumb question of the week. Is a stock market crash good for long-term returns?
Yes.
What, always? Because I imagine there's been crashes where there isn't a recovery, certainly in the domestic market.
Well, it depends what it does to you. I mean, if it really stops you from investing, no. And I think that's the thing I've learned, which is if you speak to people, you could almost predict what their attitude to risk is, depending on whether they were investing through the financial crisis. For people who have, they've been scarred by it and made too cautious as a result, and they'll probably underperform as a result. So I think what people don't usually think about is the psychological effects of living through a crash, and that can traumatise you in a way. I'd call it post-traumatic underperformance syndrome, PTUS.
I like that. But the broad idea here is that in a crash, valuations fall for stocks, and therefore expected long-term returns increase. So it's a good time to buy if you believe in mean reversion when it comes to stocks.
And the other assumption is you've got cash to allocate. So I think if you're 100% allocated to stocks in the first place, well, there's pretty cold comfort if you haven't got money down the back of the sofa.
No, I don't know about that. Like, if you just retired and you're 100% in stocks and the market's crashed, it is comforting that, okay, I'm drawing more as a percentage of my portfolio now, but the expected return when I model it is higher, so it offsets it somewhat.
Yeah, but then you're thinking, well, every pound I withdraw now is going to not be compounding for a long period of time. So I think that's a kind of trade-off mentally. Whereas if I speak to people who are young and they talk about crashes, market crashes, for them, it's a great thing. And I always joke with them, if you could possibly create a market crash, it would be great for you.
But the interesting thing about that paper we talked so much about is that one of the reasons they cite for 100% stocks actually having a lower risk of ruin is that this increase in expected returns when a market crashes is a big reason why hanging on for the long term in stocks can still allow you to eat throughout your retirement.
Yeah, and the confidence that it will bounce back. And I think that's a big difference between single stock investing and index investing, which is that for indices, it's never a question of whether it's going to bounce back, it's a question of when. Whereas if you buy a stock which crashes in value, could it go to zero? Yeah, absolutely. It could go to zero, not recover at all. So that's one of the benefits of buying something which is hugely diversified.
Do you think the US and its ridiculously strong performance for 100 years has skewed the data here? Because you can easily find markets where there's been a crash and it hasn't recovered. So we said Japan has been down for over 30 years and is just recovering now. And there are even markets where they've gone out of existence, right? Either due to communism or war or whatever. So there are certain kinds of market crash where it might not be so comforting.
Yeah, and they talk about that in the paper. They talk about markets which cease to exist, like China, like Russia.
Czechoslovakia after the war, I believe, is one of those sites.
Yeah, which is interesting. I didn't know about that one. But they factor all of that into their calculations, into the simulations. So it does happen. What hasn't happened is a huge change in behavior. So let's say that the entire world became post-scarcity and we invented universal fabricators and we didn't need capitalism because our basic needs were met, everyone. Then, yeah, obviously that would affect the returns.
It's bad for markets, but if you've got no constraints on consumption anyway, who needs investments, right?
Exactly.
If we can all
so
have
I think
whatever we want.
That kind of scenario would be okay. Another scenario which wouldn't be okay is a pandemic that really does wipe out a large proportion of the population or some other natural disaster, which is catastrophic. So I think there, it's very unlikely to happen, but it could. So those kind of situations, you couldn't recover. But it's always a matter of balancing tail risk and the most likely case. And if you just live your life for the tail risks, you're going to underperform probably.
So you said that when you're young, a stock market crash is basically a good thing if you're earning and adding money to your portfolio every month. Where's the cutoff point where we'd rather a crash to where we're scared of a crash? Obviously, we're very scared of a crash at the point of retirement. That's the worst time, as we've discussed. And if we're 20 years old, we love a crash. So where does it flip? Or is that the question we just can't answer because that's the de-risking question?
Yeah, I think it is a de-risking question, but I think usually you have to look at the periods for which drawdowns have occurred. And it's been very unusual to have markets, global markets, stock markets, not recover for 10 years. Most of the crashes that we get usually are very short-lived, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Occasionally you get double crises like the dot-com and the global financial crisis back-to-back, but that would probably be the worst-case scenario. Well, worst case scenario is that everything collapses. But of course, it's hardly worth thinking about that.
The one I worry about more than an actual short, sharp market crash is a long period of stagnation, like the 70s. That's horrible if you get that, where you've got high inflation, low growth, bad stock returns. And it's horrible because it's going to last longer than whatever safe money you've set aside. You set aside 3 years spending, well, here's a decade where you're down 60%.
You know, I think if you were allocated to the UK at that time, it would have been problematic. But there were good returns that followed that. So as long as you managed to get through the rough period, you would have been okay. But you can always be unlucky with the time period. And unfortunately, we don't choose when we're born and when we die.
It's the frustrating thing with all this modelling is we have distributions and averages and means and medians. But we don't know which one of those things we're going to be on. And we're going to have literally one set of returns.
Yeah, we're not quantum creatures. We don't live multiple possible paths. And unfortunately, there's one path we're going to follow. You've just got to do your best possible job at planning for that path.
Thank you for joining us for Many Happy Returns. Do send us your questions, no matter how dumb, at the email address mhr@pensioncraft.com.
And do remember to check out pensioncraft.com for all the information about our membership and investment coaching options.
Many Happy Returns is a PensionCraft production, co-hosted and executive produced by Romin Nakiza and Michael Pugh. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes and is not financial advice. We do not provide recommendations or endorse any decision to buy, sell or hold any security. We cannot be held responsible for any actions listeners may take, and investors are encouraged to seek independent financial advice.